Yeah, Chafei Amud Beis, 12th wide line, Omar Rav Yehuda. Omar Rav Yehuda, Akum Arum. Right? Akum Arum. First word on the line is Arum. Also Likros Kriya Shema Kenegdoi. You are not allowed to recite Kriya Shema or any other Divrei Kedusha in the presence of the nakedness of a goy. So the Gemara says, "Ma'iroi akum." What? There's a special issur to recite Kriya Shema in the presence of a goy. Why specifically a goy? Hafili Yisrael Nami. This whole parak we've been saying that you're not allowed to recite Divrei Kedusha even in the presence of a Jew's nakedness. So the Gemara says, "No, he wanted to stress the other way around." Yisrael pshita leida asur. We knew, of course, that a Jew's nakedness is asur. Ela akum itzricha leim. But the chiddush is that also a guy's nakedness is asur. Mao detema, because you might think that perhaps not. Why not? Hold your ears, Rabbi Yisai. Hoil v'ksiv buhu, since the pasuk says, asher b'sar chamorim b'sarom. It says about the idolaters that their flesh is like donkey's flesh. So you might say a guy's nakedness is nothing. It's like an animal's nakedness, that you're certainly allowed to recite Kriya Shema in the presence of a naked animal. So Kamash Malon. Therefore, we had to tell you that no, the inunami ikre erva. That they also, at the end of the day, it is called nakedness. How do we know that? Yiksiv, the ervas avihem loiro. They did not see the nakedness of their father. This is talking about Noach and his children. So they did not have the status of Jews. And yet it says that calls it nakedness as well. Oh, shkoyach, good point. So let's understand, the Gemara is actually making an interesting point here. That, yeah, the guy, on the one hand, he's not a Jew. And put it this way, you know, people will say, do we hold goyim to be inferior? We have a higher opinion of goyim than they have of themselves, because in the big world out there, you know, they say man is the most intelligent of beasts, right? That's basically what's going on in this Gemara. How do we view men in general? So, on the one hand, Yisrael is a species of its own. That's really what mankind is. Man is Yisrael. Man is, to appreciate what man is. Man is not just, you know, the sweaty hunk of flesh that we're used to when we look in the mirror. It's not who you are. And man is the crown jewel of the creation. Man is a neshama that extends to the highest of places. What we're familiar with is the bottommost level of man, but really you contain much more greatness than you see. That's what man is. But that's the Jew. So what's the guy? Is he the most intelligent of beasts? So on the one hand, in comparison to the Jew, it's true, the guy is not what we call that grand creature called man. Does that mean that he's an animal? The answer is no, he's not an animal either. As far as we're concerned, there are a few categories. We categorize existence as there's inanimate, there's plant life, there's animal life, then there's the human being, and then there's the next species in and of itself is the Jew. Sounds chauvinistic, egoistic? Well, that's how the Torah wants us to think. That's how the Torah wants us to think. What's that? Oh, so let me ask you, is it also to recite Shema in the presence of the nakedness of an animal? So the answer is that no. The more sublime the being, when you're talking about man, his nakedness is all the more a contrast with who he is. When you're talking about an animal, let's say you're talking about a donkey. I don't know if we would say that his nakedness is all that more base than his mouth. What are you talking about, a donkey? Right? It's all just animalistic existence. Right? His nakedness is not more animal than the rest of his body. It's all just animal. Right? When you're talking about man, you're talking about man, who man is a very, very great being. In man's mind, man's intellect, man's emotions, man can soar to the highest of places. For him, that nakedness represents something that very much conflicts with who he is. What's that? That's right. But what we're saying is that the nakedness is all the more pronounced. It's again, it's the issue of contrast. The nakedness is all the more pronounced the higher the being is. And therefore, when you're talking about a Jew who is essentially a sublime creature, right? The nakedness is all the more of a contrast. It's like a stark contrast, right, with who he is. And that's like we discussed before. That's really the idea of clothing. Right? We wear clothing because we don't want to be in constant contact with our animalistic part of us. But since a non-Jew is a notch down from who a Jew is, so the nakedness is not as much of a conflict. Basically, he begins and ends with material existence. He begins and ends with physical existence, right? There's a little more physical, there's a little less physical, right? There's the, you know, he eats, he does his other things. It's all basically all part of the same thing. It's physical from beginning to end. But when you're talking about a Jew, when you're talking about that's the real Tzelem Elokim, no. A Jew's existence is not a physical existence. This is also what we're bringing out. The whole, we keep saying that a Jew has to have something separating between the heart and the erva, right? We want to have clearly distinguish between, kind of put away the animalistic elements of ourselves, and just we raise up the heart and the mind and the head and all that is really in a much higher place. So that's why the erva of a Jew is all the more of a problem. But the more physical and the more material the being is, okay, the erva is not a little more animalistic, a little less animalistic. His eyes and ears and mouth is also animalistic. So the erva is a little more animalistic. It's not as much of a problem. It's more of a problem, right? Where is a splatter of mud more of a problem? On a beautifully clean thing, or on something that's basically dirty anyways? Right? It's more of a problem on a beautifully clean thing. So that's the idea here.
But still,
what's that?
Is that just still a Tzelem Elokim?
There are different elements of Tzelem Elokim. And in the broad picture, yes, definitely a non-Jew is a Tzelem Elokim. There are elements of Tzelem Elokim that a non-Jew doesn't have. But in the broad picture, really what Tzelem Elokim means, Tzelem Elokim isn't Tzelem Elokim is a potential. It isn't necessarily a virtue. Tzelem Elokim means that he has godly material to him, and that means the human intellect. The human intellect with the whole means the whole emotion system, right? The human depth of character, the human depth of personality. That's Tzelem Elokim, because a guy also can reach the highest places with that. But the question is, what you go and do with it? A person just uses all that Tzelem. The way the Sforno puts it is that Tzelem Elokim means godly material. That's what it means. The question is, what are you going to do with that material? You can make something godly out of it, or you can take that godly material and just use it to further an animalistic existence. So it's material. The goyim have that material too. That means the intellect, the heart, the capability of reaching the highest of places.
So theoretically, if you have goyim as an enlightenment leader himself, that is like
you would be. So on the contrary, this is actually the point the Gemara is bringing out. Lamaisa animals, goyim are not animals. And this is very interesting. Maral shows how it depends from where you're looking at it. He says that when a Jew is looking down at the rest of existence, the goyim might appear like the rest of the animals to him. But from the perspective of, if you're coming from the other direction, right, if you're looking from the perspective of a Jew, the guy might be the most intelligent of beasts, but it's not really true. When you're coming from the perspective of an animal, the guy is a much higher creature, the human being. And that's kind of what this Gemara is saying. On the one hand, he's not a Jew, so you might say, okay, it just doesn't make a difference. But on the other hand, we say, no. At the end of the day, a guy also, we have to realize, a guy has sublime potential. A guy has within him the capability of reaching the greatest of things. That's what I'm talking about. What's that?
He can become a Jew.
He can become a Jew, exactly. That's right. An animal can't become a ger. The guy has the capability at least of plugging in. A dog can be as sincere as he wants, never become a ger. I guess it depends. Well, you know, we have to be, right, we talk about tolerance. Maybe there are certain circles that would say that he can, and we have to respect that, certainly. Especially since soon they're going to have their own plaza at the Kaisel also. But, but yes, a guy can connect to very great things, and that's the point that the Gemara is bringing out. At the end of the day, no. A guy is not an animal. Now, generally speaking, this won't be all that nagea to us, but you know where it could be nagea? For a male who is circumcising a ger. That's where this becomes primarily relevant. That generally you're not going to be reciting psukim in the presence of a naked guy. I don't know, you have to urgently have to say Asher Yotzar in the gym. I don't know, but when you have a male who's circumcising a guy, this comes into play. He will not be allowed to recite the brachas when the erva is uncovered. They'll have to cover the erva, then recite the brachas, and then they'll go ahead and circumcise. That's where the place can bring this down. Is,
well, why would you make the brachas
directly relevant? If you're being malagoy for gerus.
Oh,
for gerus, yeah. That's right. It's a problem. Yeah, it's the same as the Jews. It's the same as the Jews, Lamaisa. And that also, the place can distinguish. They say a guy is erva, therefore you have to realize, yeah, a male is circumcising a guy, but have to make sure to cover it when he's reciting the brachas. And like you said, you can't have it in the presence of Sfarim, etc. A child, though, is not considered an erva. It's a machloikis hapoiskim. What's with the child's erva? Also, machloikis is basically about this question. There were those, the Rishonim say, who at every bris they would make a point of covering the baby while they made the brachas, and then they would uncover it because it's in the presence of an erva. But the ma'aseh, the conclusion of the poiskim is that an erva is not called an erva until a child is at the age where he's capable of cohabiting. Which is, when you're talking about a boy from the age of 9. Before the age of 9, a child's erva is not called an erva, and therefore, for example, the most direct implication of this is by a bris mila. There's no need to cover the erva when performing a bris. And yes, in general, there's no iser to recite the rekdusha in view of an erva of a small child. Although we'll note that there are shitas that are machmir, so it might be kedai not to do it stam. But lemaisa, when it comes lemaisa, the halacha is that erva is only considered an erva once the person is capable of cohabiting. Okay. The guy, meaning without underwear. It's only mamish the nakedness, the male organ. That's the only problem. What's that? Oh, so by a Goyish woman, things get a little more complicated. Because we already discussed that, let's say, you're not allowed to recite the Kedusha by a man. Okay, once his nakedness is covered, you're fine. But how does it work with Goyish women? Let's say you're sitting on a city bus, you're sitting on a train. You want to make a bracha. You're surrounded by women who don't have their hair covered. Married women, Goyish married women. A married woman doesn't have to cover her hair. What's the halacha? We already discussed. Now we're seeing that the erva of guy is also called an erva. What about these elements of the erva? Uncovered parts of a woman's body. So what
I thought even by a Jewish woman who has uncovered.
Oh, so that, you're not allowed to.
I thought you were. I think Moshe made about it that it was so commonplace or something like that?
There are those, it's not ideal. There is room to be mako in pressing circumstances since it became commonplace. And the truth is, that's lamaisa, the answer for a guy. Since by a guy it's legitimate for her to have her hair uncovered, and it's also commonplace, there is no problem reciting the rekdusha in the presence of a goyish woman's uncovered hair. With a Jewish woman's uncovered hair, it's more problematic. The general consensus of the poskim is not to do it, even in areas where there are parrots about it. There are poskim who are mako, and we might say that it's something that can be relied on b'shas adchak. But the general consensus, the mishabura's psak, etc., is that when it comes to a Jewish woman, since it's illegitimate for her to have her hair uncovered, a person should not recite the rekdusha, even if a lot of women go around like that.
What about the elbows?
Generally speaking, the same idea. Again, mishas adchak, you might be able to be mako with the elbows uncovered. But generally speaking, it's the same idea. Again, the Mishnah Berurah rules that with all these things, the person should be makpid. You cover your eyes or turn away or something like that, so that you don't see it. Okay.
Why
would we say that the Kriya Shema again? All the Kriya Shema? The Gemara talks about Kriya Shema the whole time, but it's relevant for all the Kriya Shema.
Why
is
the Kriya
Shema? That's the subject of the Perek. That's a nice and a gear for everything.
But isn't Kriya Shema generally more chamor than a regular bracha?
What's that?
Isn't Kriya Shema generally more chamor than a regular bracha?
In this regard?
I don't mean to say in general. We've dealt with things Shmon Esrei, Kriya Shema.
I don't know if Kriya Shema, well, in certain senses, in the issue of how much kavanah you have to have, but in other senses, not. For example, after the first two psukim of Kriya Shema, you're allowed to move around and do things, make your adin. While in a bracha, you're not allowed. So it's hard to compare one to the other. Okay. We move on. Oh, walking around. No, you shouldn't be doing things. Don't wipe your hands while you're saying the bracha. V'lo yiskasa, we move on. Back to a quote from the Mishnah. The Mishnah had said, V'lo yiskasa lo b'mayim haroim v'lo b'me'ar mishra. You are not allowed to, if a person, again, we say he's in the water, he wants to recite Kriya Shema. So you can consider yourself covered by the water as long as you make it, you stir the water about a little so you can't see down to your erva. But not if it's filthy water, or if it's water used to soak flax. This also had a very bad smell. So if you're in such water, you can't recite Divrei Kedusha. Achiyati l'teichon mayim, unless you pour water into it to kind of dilute it. So let's think about this practically. You're inside the water, which means that it's at least like a bath. You want to dilute it. We say you need to dilute it. How much water are you going to have to pour into dilute it? It's just not worth the effort, right? So the Gemara asks, "Kama mayaromi va'ozil?" How much water are you supposed to pour? You want to, you're in a pond or in a bath or in a mikvah of dirty water. How much water are you going to have to pour in order to dilute it? Ela hachikama. Rather, no. The Mishnah means something else. Lo yiskase lo b'mayim haroim. Do not cover yourself in filthy water. Or in water used for soaking flax, klal. You're not allowed to recite anything while you're in that water. And then the Mishnah introduces a new subject, which it hadn't discussed up till then, umeraglayim, and if there's urine nearby, you cannot recite Divrei Kedusha, ad sheyati l'teichon mayim v'yikro. Until you pour water in and dilute it, then you can recite Divrei Kedusha. So yes, you can dilute urine in order to be able to recite Divrei Kedusha in its presence. And that's what we're going to discuss now. The truth is, this might or might not be very relevant for us, because nowadays all urinating that we do generally, unless you, is automatically diluted. You do it into water, which is a lot more than the necessary shear to dilute. Let's see how this works. Tanu Rabbanan. Says in the Brayse, Kama yati l'toicham. How much water must you pour in order to dilute the urine, in order to be permitted to recite Divrei Kedusha in its presence? Mayim kolshu, any amount of water. As we've already learned earlier, urine is only a problem in derabbanan once it's already on the ground, and therefore the chacham omer meikel, any amount of water will do. Rabbi Zakkai Omer Reviz. Rabbi Zakkai says, no, you need a Reviz. Now the truth is that this is also a Kula. This is also a Kula, because Lamaisa, generally, urine is going to be more than a Reviz. Significantly more. So both opinions are saying that it's kind of symbolic that you dilute it. You don't really have to be Mevatali. You don't have to have more water. The question is how far the Chachamim went. The Tanakhama says mamish symbolic. You pour in a drop and that's all. Zakkai says it has to be a significant amount of water or reviz. But whatever the case is, there's more urine here than water anyways.
What
would the drop
do?
What's that? Symbolic. Meaning the whole Isser is derabbanan. The Chachamim said once you dilute it, good enough. Dilute it even minimally. Yeah.
Pure,
well, what's that? Oh, you're raising a good point. What about the odor? So the truth is, and here we're going to come back to what we said about feces in the past also. If there's odor, all this doesn't apply. Meaning odor is a problem, period. What's that? So what we're assuming is we're dealing with a case where there isn't an odor. Meaning, let's say it's you're in the outdoors or whatever it is. You're in the outdoors, or
here's a divorce. It doesn't say that it's more popular. So,
what I think
it does, it's in a vessel.
What's that?
It's in a vessel.
So it could be in a vessel. It could be not in a vessel. Meaning, either way, both scenarios will be the same thing. But you're right. It will depend on whether there's an odor or not. If there's an odor, which is more likely to be the case when it's in a vessel indoors, and a chanami, pouring in water won't help until you can get rid of the odor. But let's say it's on the floor. Let's say it's on the floor. A person just urinated on the floor. Okay, it's kind of spread out over the area. It's not going to cause who knows what of an odor. It's outdoors. So you just come, you pour a little water in, that'll be. But you're right. This is all qualified by, provided that there's no odor.
Urine odor is what you're...
Yeah. In fact, that the place can say is mamish the same as feces. It's already a nisa d'oraisa, just like feces, if there's actually an odor. What's that? If it's something that's very, very offensive, then yes, it is. Well, there it's because you have so much that it's kind of ridiculous. But with urine, at least in a symbolic way, the water does something, right? The water that you're pouring in does something. When we talk about Mayim Mishra, we're talking about a case where you're actually sitting in it. The point is the volume, that's the point. You're actually sitting in it. You're sitting in it. You know, you're talking about a bath, a pool full of it. Oh, you're going to pour a cup of water into it and dilute it. It's ridiculous.
So one drop works for urine.
Well, according to the Tanakhama, we'll see. We'll see if we go with that. What's that?
Arvias.
Yeah, but still, the Rambam stresses, by the way, that we're talking about one round of urine. You need a Arvias for each round of urine.
It can't be too much urine, otherwise it would smell. It was a lot of urine.
Right. We're talking about one shot. So one shot of Arvias, you're right, it's not going to outdo it, but it'll help. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll note also, by the way, that even the odor will also depend. If they drank more than or people who drink more, the urine will have less of an odor. It's automatically more diluted. So it's not so far-fetched, right? On
depends on what they ate.
So it always, it'll depend on the reality, right? Well, that's also provided that there's no odor. That's also provided that there's no odor. You're right, the Gemara doesn't spell that out, but the place can do. Now, Omar Rav Nachman, so when I say I have this machlokes, how much do you need to dilute it? Any amount or a viz? So Rav Nachman says, machlokes lebesleif. This whole machlokes is if the urine was there first and then you're pouring in water. Then, Rabbi Zakkai requires a viz. Aval bitchila, but if you put the water in first and then you urinate into the water, kol shehin. Everybody agrees that any amount will do. Why? Because when the water is there first, the water has the home field advantage in that as the urine is coming in, each drop is being bottled. Let's say you have a little bit of water, but the first urine that hits it is inevitably even less than that, right? So as it comes in, it's bottled. So therefore, if the water is there before the urine, any amount will do. What do you mean? We're keeping up that qualification that all this discussion is provided you don't smell it. But we're talking from an halachic perspective. If there's no smell, do we view this as urine or not? So you say it depends if it's batel in the water. And if there was water before the urine, whatever urine comes in is batel. Rav Yosef says no, the other way around. Machlokes lechatchila. The whole machlokes here is if you have the water there beforehand. Only then is the Tanakhama Mekel and says that any amount will do. But if the urine is already there and you want to pour water in, divrei hakol reviz. You definitely have to pour in a reviz. Omar le'Rav Yosef l'shameh. And what's the bottom line halacha on this? Rav Yosef told his attendant when there was urine and he wanted to recite whatever it was, I see the revi'isa de maya, bring me a revi'isa of water, ki Rabbi Zakkai. Like Rabbi Zakkai. Meaning we are machmer, we pass in the chumra.
So they were not flipping it that everyone held the revi'is. But okay. The first approach that only Rabbi Zakkai held as a revi'is, and not the second approach, and we said that maybe even the Tanakh and everyone else would also agree with the revi'is.
No, this is Rabbi Yosef, right? And remember, this is Rabbi Yosef, who said, he went with the more chumra approach. He said that if it's after the urine is already there, everybody agrees you need a reviz. But he saw beforehand. He was coming to urinate in the first place. He said, put in a reviz before I urinate. Right? Because
he was
being machmir like Rabbi Zakkai.
Tanakama would agree to that also or no?
No, if you're putting the water in beforehand, then the Tanakama will be meko. And Lamaisa, this is how he passed like Rabbi Zakkai, that whether it's there beforehand or afterwards, it takes a reviz to dilute the urine. Now this should generally mean that none of our urine should be a problem, because we're always, I mean, generally speaking, it's always done into a toilet which has water in it. But yet, we'll see that although it's true that when you urinate into a toilet, the urine itself is not a problem, as we'll see soon, the toilet itself might be a problem, irrespective of the urine. That's coming up now. But whatever it is, we just concluded the sugi that yes, what does it take to dilute reviz, to dilute urine or reviz? Tanu Rabbanan. Ebraisa teaches as follows. Now this is very lemaisa in trying to determine. This next amud and a half is very lemaisa in determining how we treat our bedrooms. Graf shel rei. If you have a pot used for feces, va'ovit shel meraglayim, or a pot used for urine, a chamber pot, whether it's just for feces or just for urine, also likros kriya shma kenegdo, you are not allowed to recite kriya shma in their presence, afal pi she'ein bohem klum, even if there's nothing in it. Meaning, a vessel that's used for going to the bathroom is in and of itself considered like feces.
Just a bit of a, as long as there's no order, urinating something with water.
Oh, so let's see.
Here, you got an empty vessel. No urine. So it can't be the odor. Now you're saying you can't.
Well, let's see. First of all, not necessarily. Think in terms of, you're thinking in terms of our toilets, which even then they can get, when you think of a house with little kids in it, you can have a toilet with nothing in it, it can be pretty, have a pretty bad smell. But think in terms of a chamber pot. Okay, you're talking about an earthenware vessel, which right now happens to be empty. But how does it usually work? Right? It gets nice and full, and it sits there until, you know, every 24 hours someone deigns to pour it out. That thing is going to smell pretty bad even when there's nothing there. Right? Especially, the poskim also know that they were earthenware. Earthenware was absorbent. It was hard to get this stuff clean. You didn't wash it in the dishwasher and then use it for chalent. Okay? So now, and therefore, yes, what we're saying is that a chamber pot is in and of itself awesome. And if you have urine, not in a chamber pot, then it's awesome unless you put water in the ikra, and then you can recite it. So let's note, there's something ironic here, and this is kind of connected to the point you just raised. What we're saying here is that a chamber pot used for urine is treated more severely than urine itself. That's what we're saying here. You have urine on the floor, pour water in and you're okay. Okay? But a chamber pot used for urine that's currently empty is more problematic. Why is that? Makes sense if you think of it in practical terms. A chamber pot used for urine is likely to be used regularly for urine, and that has had urine sitting in it, right? Is likely to be a lot more foul, even when it's empty, than urine that happens to be on the floor. And therefore, yes, a chamber pot is considered like tzaya in and of itself.
The fact that it has urine
What's that? What's that? But the truth is, so yes and no. The truth is that the place can say that even if it's mamish clean, it's still aser. But the truth is that you're right. I wouldn't say that it's because it's designated. But I still want to say that let's start applying this to our toilets. So first of all, the place can say that the full severity of the din of a chamber pot really only applies, like we said, to absorbent things. Like wood or clay cheres, earthenware, right? But things, for example, the place can say like metals or glass don't have this din. They don't have this din. And therefore, let's say you have a metal or something like that. If that were to be completely scrubbed out and cleansed, you would also have to turn it over, because the very fact that it's designated for that already gives it a problematic status. But you also turn it over such that the bottom side is not exposed. That would be okay. Again, the problem is not, you can't cleanse it because it's mamish absorbed. That's the thing. You're talking about wood or earthenware, it's mamish through and through, saturated. I don't have so clear. The place can discuss our toilets, and I just was a little confused about the Metzius, because the Mishnah Berurah seems to differentiate between porcelain, which he says is a problem, and glazed earthenware, which he says there's more room to be makel. And according to my understanding, isn't porcelain glazed earthenware? I thought that's what it is. What are our toilets? What's that? They're porcelain, right? So, now what is porcelain? I don't know. I'm just a little confused as to what's it. And is it then coated with something?
Porcelain is a coating over metal or something else.
Porcelain is a coating.
In itself, it's a coating.
And what's the nature of the coating? You said enamel. What's enamel? What? It's like a glass. Oh, what?
It's similar to glass.
Okay. So if you're talking about these types of materials, so the truth is that the place can say that these things, our toilets, there's room to say that they have the din of the less severe types of materials. The things that are non-absorbent, which would mean that, practically speaking, it doesn't make that much... It makes some differences, as we'll see soon. But if they were to be very well cleaned, again, generally speaking, you can't assume them to be clean, but if they were to be very well cleaned and also covered... covered is okay in any case. If they were to be very well cleaned, they're not emitting an odor, there's more room to be makel. What exactly that means, that there's more room to be makel, we'll see as we go along. But there's more room to be makel. Not to consider it with having that full status of tzaya itself.
Maybe that can affect whether someone can wash there.
What's that?
Maybe that can affect whether someone can wash.
That's right, that does affect. The truth is that there's two questions we have to address. First of all, what's the status of the toilet itself? And second of all, what's the status of the bathroom? Because it's two different dinim, as we're going to see soon. It's two separate discussions. It's also to recite the Rekdusha in a bathroom, and it's also to recite the Rekdusha in the presence of a toilet. These are two separate halachas, and therefore both have to be addressed when we're going to be talking about our toilets. So we'll get there. We'll put it all together as we go along. But yeah, we would say l'maisa that there's room to be makel with washing in a bathroom.
Washing but not making a bracha.
Yeah, not making a bracha. We'll see as we go along. We'll see the details. We'll develop the details. But that we will say, yes, our toilets are considered chamber pots, but they're considered the less severe type of chamber pots. They're considered the type of chamber pots that could be cleansed and have a more lenient status, as we'll see.
You can't recite Krishma on the bathroom.
Lemais, the bottom line is that you can't. But yet, we'll see that there are certain nafkaminas, there are certain areas in which there might be more room for leniency in our bathrooms. Like, let's say, for example, in a real in a real bathroom of earlier times, you certainly couldn't wash there either, right? Or even more than that, you couldn't wash there either. And also, you couldn't recite any Divrei Kedusha facing the bathroom if the bathroom door is open. We'll have to see how that works with our bathrooms. It could be that with our bathrooms it's better to avoid it, but there's room to be makel. We'll see as we go along. Another nafkamina is that in toilets of earlier, in bathrooms of earlier times, even the walls were considered to be saturated. So even the wall was considered as having the status of a bathroom. You couldn't recite Kriya Shema opposite the wall of a bathroom from the outside. That's how it worked in earlier times. Again, in our times, there's room to be a lot more room to be makel with these things for a lot of different reasons. Another reason to be more makel with our bathrooms is that our bathrooms are not really 100% bathrooms because you use them for other things as well. You brush your teeth there regularly, right? And you keep things there, you keep medicines and stuff there. That already also undermines its status as a proper bathroom. So there is room for certain leniencies with regard to our bathroom. We'll see. I want to let it properly develop as we go along.
The bathrooms that you find in the houses.
In what?
The bathrooms that we have at home. We're doing the bathrooms, say, in the houses where
Well, that's because your mamish not in where the toilet is.
Right.
It's not called a bathroom. For halachic purposes, it's not a bathroom.
Right. But at home, that's not so.
It's not so, but yet, it's more lenient than the bathrooms of olden times. Again, we're not saying it's more lenient than the bathrooms of olden times. Now, I'm not saying it's not a bathroom. It's a bathroom of a lower status, which has halachic implications. We'll see. We'll develop it as we go along. We'll see. Well, a shower is a merchatz. That's a problem in and of itself. It's a separate problem. Meaning the fact that if you have just a shower stall, that's a problem in and of itself. Yeah, merchatz is basically the same story as a bathroom, as a lavatory. Right. Unless it's an area that's just used like for, you know, brushing your teeth and beautifying yourself. Okay, let's see. Now, so the kamayatil, so again, we said chamber pot, you can't recite anything in their presence. Urine itself, you have to dilute it. The kamayatil, how much water must you pour into it? Kolshu. Any amount, like we saw earlier, that's the same tanakama. Rabbi Zakkai Eimer, same Rabbi Zakkai says, reviz. Bein lifnei hamita, bein la'acha hamita. And this makes no difference whether the urine is on your side of the bed or on the other side of the bed. Meaning the fact that it's on the other side of the bed doesn't help. You still have to either dilute it or distance yourself 4 amas. Aben Shimon ben Gamliel Eimer, he says, no, it doesn't make a difference. La'acha hamita koyre. If it's on the other side of the bed, you can recite Divrei Kedusha. Lifnei hamita einai koreh. If it's on your side of the bed, you cannot recite Divrei Kedusha. Aval marchik hu arba amas v'koreh. You would have to distance yourself 4 amas and then recite Divrei Kedusha. Rabbi Shimon ben Elozar Eimer, here we have, he's the most machmir. This is a famous shita. Afilu bayis meya ama. Even if your house, your room is 100 amas, lo yikra, you're not allowed to recite the rikdusha if there's urine in the room, ad sheyitzeim o sheyanichem tachas hamita, until you either take it out of the room or you put it under the bed where it's considered to be buried. He says that even if you're 100 amas away but you're in the same room, it's asur. Why? Because he maintains, this is the famous shita, that a room is always considered 4 amas, right? Therefore, no matter how big the room is, you're never far enough. Bayisim means a room, yeah. In earlier times, basically the home was a room. Okay. That's why I heard Shlomo Miller once said that he made a cheshbon somehow. Shemillion to round the Meir Cheshbon somehow that he came up that Bdikas Chometz in the time of the Gemara took about an hour. So you know, everybody said, "Oh wow! So are we overdoing it if it takes us 3-4 hours?" And then he said, "But remember that in those days they had one room and not much possessions. If you have 9 rooms, make the math. But so okay, our 3-4 hours is the kula. Okay, but yeah, room generally, house generally means room in the Gemara. Now, so we have 3 shitas here. Tanakama said makes no difference if it's before, in front of, or behind the bed. Shimon Gamliel said it does make a difference. Behind the bed you can't say Kriya Shema. Sorry, if it's in front of the bed you cannot say Kriya Shema. If it's behind the bed you can. You have to go 4 amos away. Now the truth is that statement is a little ambiguous, because he says, you know, in front of the bed you have to be machmir, behind the bed you can be mekel, you have to go 4 amos away. Now what did he mean when he said you have to go 4 amos away? It's a little ambiguous. So the Gemara asks, Iboyeluhu, we wonder, Heichika Omar, what did he mean? Acha amito kari miyad, did he mean to say, well, if it's on the other side of the bed, you can recite the Rekdusha immediately, without distancing yourself at all. Lifnei amito marchika ba amis v'kari, but if it's on your side of the bed, you have to go 4 amis away. Oydilma hachika Omar, which means we're understanding, this first understanding is the more lenient view, the more lenient possibility. That he's being mekel. He's saying, in the worst case, you have to distance yourself 4 amos away if it's with you. If it's on the other side of the bed, you don't have to distance yourself at all. Or maybe no. He's saying a chumra. La'acha amito ma'achik dalad amos v'kore. If it's on the other side of the bed, then it suffices to go 4 amos away. But if it's on your side of the bed, maybe you cannot recite at all. So what did he mean by saying, on the other side of the bed, yes, on this side of the bed, no, go 4 amos away? Did he mean to permit this side of the bed, or did he mean to limit if it's on the other side of the bed? So Tashma, we'll try to prove in the following. The Tanya, from Shimon Elazar Oimer, here it's presented a little more clearly. Achar hamito kari miyad. Yes, that's what he meant. If it's on the other side of the bed, you can recite Kriya Shema immediately. Lifnei hamito. If it's on your side of the bed, marchik arba amos. Then you have to go 4 amos away. So he meant the more lenient understanding. Shem megamli aloimer, afilu bayis mea amo, is the more machmir opinion. Shem megamli says, even if the house is 100 amos wide, lo yikro, you still cannot recite the Rekdusha as long as the urine is there, until you either take it out of the room, or you put it under the bed. Okay. The bed had legs. The bed had legs and it was somewhat raised above the ground. So you're wondering, what does it help if it's on the other side of the bed? Lamaise, it's still exposed. It's not... Right. So some of Farshim understand that the bed of those times were actually like boxes. They were closed down to the bottom. And therefore, if it's on the other side of the bed, it's kind of like it's behind the wall. Right?
That's not a very tall wall.
That's going to be coming up. That we'll see.
What do you mean the beds were boxes?
There wasn't like a space. It wasn't 4 legs. It was walls coming down. It was like picture a box that you... What's that? Well, no, the question is, does raglay mean picture an upside down box? Long upside down box. So raglay might be the walls of the box. But the truth is, Anachanami, you're right. Not all the mafarshim commit themselves to this understanding. There are mafarshim that say that, no, it's a kula that Chazal implemented, again, based on the premise that urine is only derabanan, and therefore, yeah, once it's on the other side of the bed, even if it's not a box, even if it's just legs, it's okay. We're going to see a little more as we go along. No, it's about urine in a vessel. Urine in a vessel. Now,
but if there was to urinate directly on the floor, the ground, then it would be considered covered up in the soil.
After it's already not wet anymore. If they would touch the ground, they not feel moisture.
But you cover it over with
sand. Right, that would also do. Once it's covered, it's okay. Whatever it is, the Gemara just notes, Bayan if Shitalon. Our question was answered, meaning we got the answer to our question that yes, that middle shita's intent was, and on the other side of the bed it's fine, whatever the case is. If it's on your side of the bed, you have to go far on this away. But masnaisa kashina adadi. But masnaisa, we didn't notice, but these two brises are contradicting each other. Because the previous brisa had Rishim and Gamliel saying that on the other side of the bed is okay, this side of the bed go far on this away. And Rishim ben Elazar said, you have to have it completely out of the room. But this last price has switched it around. Rishim ben Elazar said, have it behind the bed or go four amos away. And Rishim ben Gamliel said, you have to have it outside the room. So masnais and kashin adadi, the prices are contradicting themselves. So the Gemara says, epuch basreis. You're right, you have to reverse the last price. It's a mistaken text. Really, it's Rishim ben Gamliel who says that you have it on the other side of the bed or go four amos away. And Rishim ben Elazar says, you have to have it out of the room. So the Gemara says, you seem to be arbitrarily deciding which one to reverse. You're right, you have to reverse one of the two braises. But who said to reverse the last braise? Epoch Kamaisa. Maybe reverse the first braise. Maybe it's Rishim ben Gamliel who's machmir and says you have to have it out of the room. And Rishim ben Elazar is the one who said that it's enough if it's on the other side of the bed. So the Gemara says, no. Man shamis le da omar kulebayis ka'aba amistami. Who do we know from other places in Shas that he holds this principle that a whole house is always considered four amos? You're not considered to be distanced from anything in the room. Reb Shimon Elazari. That's Reb Shimon Elazari. So that we're applying that opinion to him here as well. Where in Shas do we find Reb Shimon Elazari saying that? Anybody? Quick review of Shas. Rashi says, I don't know. So that's one of our beautiful examples of who Rashi was. Kiveiga then, see on the bottom of the Gilyan Hashas, I want to see just a little bit of Rashi's nature. He gives you all the instances in Shas where Rashi comes out and tells us straight, I don't know. There's a whole list here of Gemaras where Rashi tells us, I don't know. But whatever it is, there was this sheet of Reb Shimon ben Elazar that a house is always considered to be not more than four amos. And therefore, if you have to be distanced from something four amos away, you have to have it out of the room. Okay? Right.